Hi, welcome to this week's program. There sure is a lot going on right now, from coronavirus worries to the election to a volatile stock market. So the last thing I want to add to anybody's list of concerns are some unconstructive thoughts about housing. However, I just read a fascinating article from The Economist magazine, my favorite mag, by the way, about how our attitude toward home ownership in this country just may be hurting us. Hurting us? Now, I'm not telling you as an individual to buy a home. That's a personal decision for you to make. But after reading the article about how home ownership is structured in this country, I think you get to see how it actually may be hurting us and not helping us. The article points out that 1/4 of the recessions in the developed world between 1960 and the 2000s were, at least in part, precipitated by sharp declines in housing prices. And those were also the recessions that were the worst and the longest lasting. And the financial crisis of 2008 is just the most recent serious example. This suggests some serious mismanagement in housing policies, and it's a problem that occurred gradually over many, many decades. The end results include thriving cities that don't have room to grow, and a generation of young people who can't afford to buy homes or even rent apartments. The blame ultimately lies with a combination of elements: a network of convoluted and corrupt housing policies, and an overwhelming obsession with home ownership. The question now is, how do we get back on the right track? There's a serious lack of building happening, particularly in or near booming cities with plenty of jobs. There's no room for the apartments in the building these cities need to accommodate the workers taking these jobs. Why? Housing and building regulations, for one. For decades, regulations have been in place that cater to homeowners, but make it nearly impossible for developers and construction companies to come in and build the housing that this modern economy needs. As a result, housing prices, both rent and home ownership, climb, which means workers can't afford to move to the places where they're most likely to find the best jobs, and that slows overall economic growth. Now, here's some facts to ponder. Housing costs in the U.S. currently take up 11% of our GDP. That is up significantly from 8% in the 1970s. And here's a statistic that blew my mind. It's estimated that if only three major cities, New York, San Francisco, and San Jose, relaxed their housing regulations a bit, the country's GDP would be as much as 4% higher. What would today's politicians and you and I wouldn't do for a 6% GDP overall with the 2% that we're getting now? So, how else has the housing market created this problem? Well, for a number of decades, interest rates have fallen. Now, while this seems like a positive, and it is in many, many ways, it's compounded an already inadequate housing inventory by leading to a seemingly nonstop surge in prices. And this occurs most heavily in America's largest cities. In other developed countries, such as the UK, the average national home prices are also skyrocketing as well. The cost of housing has created inequalities and generational divides. In 1990, baby boomers, who were at a median age of 35 back then, owned 1/3 of U.S. real estate by dollar value. In contrast, in 2019, the millennial generation, current median age of around 30, owns only 4% of our country's real estate. That's a huge disparity. The younger generation, looking at ever-rising housing costs and ultimately beginning to view owning their own home as unobtainable, may be contributing significantly to their infatuation right now with socialism. The problem began when public policies shifted in the 1950s, promoting the favorability of owning your own home. To further drive the focus on home ownership, governments then continued using tax breaks and subsidies to foster home ownership over renting. And politicians have done their part as well. Those on the right see owning a home as a way to encourage responsible citizenship. Those on the left view housing as a means of wealth distribution. But the truth is, there's no real proof that buying a house makes you a better citizen. And economically, if you take leverage out of the equation, you know what I'm talking about, your mortgage, it's actually more profitable to own stocks than a home. In addition, homeowners often become people who resist development of an area in an attempt to protect their investments. So the economists crunched some numbers which revealed that new housing construction in the developed world has fallen by 50% since 1960. So as I said before, inventory is way down, prices are up, and the entire system is skewed towards home ownership. There's a pressure towards home ownership. Most people are concerned they'll fall behind or be forgotten if they chose to rent. Politicians focus their energies on giving subsidies to marginal buyers, and it all just ends up leading to a buildup of mortgage debt that makes wide-scale economic crises much more likely. Well, there is hope. There is hope for a different way because there are places in the world which are not suffering from inventory issues or the need to own a home. Tokyo, for example, erected nearly 730,000 new homes without any negative impact on quality of life. Switzerland operates with an entirely different mindset from the one in the U.S., offering local governments financial incentives to allow and to push for new housing development. The result? There is almost twice as much home building per person in Switzerland as there is in the United States. There are even places in the world where home ownership levels are low, and that's considered okay. Germany, for example, has a home ownership rate of only 50%. It also has a rental sector that encourages long-term tenancy. See, that's important. So the result there, in contrast to the U.S., real home prices in Germany haven't risen significantly since 1980. Happily, things are starting to change. In the U.S., there's finally a cap on tax breaks for mortgage interest payments. In the U.K., the government now openly admits that the housing market is broken and needs to be fixed. Scott Morrison, Australia's prime minister, has pledged to make housing more affordable. And Canada's recent election was focused partly on reining in the country's spiraling housing costs. Well, here's to the new policies and the new attitudes that create more affordable housing for everyone in the future. And maybe it's time for all of us to rethink our old assumptions. And I'm all for that. You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. I'd like to welcome Eric Schoenberg. He is the editor-in-chief of Inc. magazine, a wonderful magazine, and Eric is with us right now. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Nice to be here. Thanks.
One of your articles that I enjoyed reading was The Four Financial Habits of Highly Effective and Wealthy CEOs. You know, Eric, with most entrepreneurs laser-focused on their business, so many forget to take care of their own personal finances. Tell us about that.
Well, you've got that absolutely right. The main thing about these four habits of highly effective and wealthy CEOs is that they avoid the biggest problem, is they don't diversify. They have all their risk and all their hopes in one basket, namely their company, and
right.
Figure that, well, sometime in the future I'll sell this for millions of dollars and I'll be set.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-hmm.
Maybe, but maybe not. So the habits are ways of getting your risk out of your company and diversifying.
Very good. So what would be the kind of the first blush habit to look to do?
The first one is to fund a dedicated retirement account.
Mm-hmm.
You may think that this is obvious, especially if you're working for a company, but for a lot of entrepreneurs, it's not obvious. They really think that it'll all be taken care of at the company. So one of the best ones, if you are a solo worker or hire only contractors, is what's called a solo 401k.
Why is that a good one?
Well, it allows you to set aside as much as $50,000 a year of retirement income. And if your wife is working for you, too, you can each do that. So mm-hmm. That adds up to $100,000.
That could build up pretty quickly.
It can. I mean, you have to have enough income to support that. But it not only can add up quickly, but it's tax deferred. So it comes off right off the top off your personal income. That's, as far as the IRS is concerned, in the year you earn it, disappears.
Right.
You only have to pay taxes on the back end when you pull the money out.
Right. And then the money grows, of course, tax deferred like an IRA or something like that.
Exactly.
Sure. So fund a dedicated retirement account for yourself once you can afford to do that. And remember, one other, I think, rule of thumb that people forget about is make sure you diversify within your pension plan. I want to discuss that in a little bit more detail later on. But let's go to number two. Number two is what?
Well, it's very similar to that idea that you just raised, which is when you fund that 401k, solo 401k, or whatever kind of retirement plan you have, profit sharing, whatever, don't overload it with your own company stock.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's an easy mistake to make because you think, well, I know this company, I have a lot of faith in it, and buying stock will show that. Well, nobody has perfect foresight into the future. You don't know that your company is going to be healthy, you know, without any interruption. So you want to spread your risk out.
Yeah.
Get some of your future out of your company and diversify it across a whole range of stocks or other investments, not just stocks.
Here's an interesting point as well. So let's say you do put some money aside in a retirement account and you don't put in your own personal, your own company stock rather, but you're in an industry and let's say you like other companies in your industry. Let's just say you're in the auto industry. It's not a great example, but you know, don't go out and buy other auto industry stocks because there's a tendency that when a cyclical industry goes out, you know, the tide goes out, all of the boats go out with it. So when you diversify, also diversify outside of your industry, not only outside of your company. What do you think of that?
I think that's a great idea. Doing otherwise is like suggesting you have a well-stocked wine cellar because you have 100 cases of wine, but they're all the same vintage.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. All right, number three, this is again the four habits, the four financial habits of highly effective and wealthy CEOs. Number three, Eric.
Is to sell some of the equity. Again, diversification is the key overriding factor here. Get the money out of your stock, out of your own stock or your own options. What you don't want to find yourself in is a situation in the future when you have to sell, when you're under pressure, mm-hmm. because you'll probably be selling at the low point in the cycle.
Do many entrepreneurs or these wealthy CEOs, do they do all this by themselves or do they put together a team to help them?
I think it's always better to have a team. You're running a business and that is a full-time job and then some. So you're not going to be current on investment and tax and retirement planning strategies. You ought to have a financial professional. You ought to have a financial planner. You probably also should have an estate planning attorney
mm-hmm.
to help you make sure that if you're not around, that your money is going to go where you want it to.
My guest is Eric Schoenberg. He is the editor-in-chief of Inc. magazine, and we're talking about the four financial habits of highly effective and wealthy CEOs. So you want to build a team. You want a tax advisor, maybe an estate planning attorney, an experienced investment advisor, someone who's working in your best interest, and someone also who knows how to work with a team of professionals to help you. So it's like any other area of your business. You know, stick to what you know and what you don't know, hire a group of experts for you. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
What does an estate planning attorney bring to the mix under this?
Well, estate planning laws are a science unto themselves. And what they can help you do is make sure that all the complications of estate planning laws and estate taxes that vary the national level and the state level work in your favor. These are mistakes that this area is fraught with mistakes that if you make them, there is no going back. Your heirs will be saddled with your mistakes forever.
Good point.
And tax rates on estates are very high. They run 55%. So that is, you know, to get something wrong, to have too much money in your estate, to have too much money in your taxable estate is a problem you will pay for.
Also, a smooth transition between you and your heirs is also pretty valuable, and estate planning can take care of that so your money doesn't get caught up in probate, which can be a public affair. Probate has to be declared to the public, but you can set up trusts and others that don't. Eric, I want to change topics here real quickly. A survey that Inc. recently conducted, I think, went against conventional wisdom because so much is written when a new company gets started about getting financing for that growing business, finding equity investors or angel investors. But your survey found something completely different. Tell us about that.
This survey was conducted with Inc. 500 CEOs. So these are the CEOs of the 500 fastest growing private companies over the past 3 years. So these are very successful people. And yet 77% of those founders told us they got their company started using their own personal savings, and nearly the same number of founders told us that they funded their growth during this growth spurt that got them into the Inc. 500 also through without going outside. They funded it with cash flow from their own operations.
You know, again, I don't know why you know, maybe it's the media's fault or it just is something to write about. I'm not really sure, but you really get the sense that the first thing you need to do is put together a business plan and go to a bank. But that, in fact, is just not the way it's done. Why isn't it done that way?
Well, there are many reasons it's not done that way. I was about to respond to the question you didn't ask about why does the press give so much attention to venture capitalists. And the answer is, you know, they're public events, they're dramatic events, they're a way to keep score. You know, I raised $13 million in an A round of funding.
Right.
I think that's the fascination for it. But remember that when you raise money from an angel or a VC, you're basically selling your company before you've even gotten started. So you lose control. And then think about all the opportunity costs, all the time you spend on roadshows, trying to drum up money distracts you from the growth in your own company.
That's very true. Yeah, I mean, I know an investor who actually did get a parent company, a private equity firm, to help fund. But as he grew this division within the company, he's funding it with his own money because in order to bring that private equity firm back in for further funding, he would have to dilute his own shares. And he was unwilling to do that. It's kind of a different take on the same subject, whether you're starting your own or whether you already have a private equity investor, but you really don't want to go back to the trough and ask for more.
Yes, that's really true. You think about it, if money were no object, you wouldn't bring in all these other people unless they really were partners and really were advisors. It can be a major distraction, you know, depending on how many investors you have. There are that many more voices who are giving you perhaps contradictory advice about what you ought to do next with your company. Raising capital from the outside is sometimes necessary, but it is almost always a mixed blessing.
So would you say that too many startup entrepreneurs look to outside capital first, rather than attempting to build incrementally through their own internal sources?
I would say that's really true. It's tempting, but the discipline that's imposed by bootstrapping your own company is the sort of thing that will serve you well over the life of your company.
Very interesting. My guest, Eric Schoenberg, editor-in-chief of Inc. magazine. Thanks so much for joining us, Eric.
My pleasure, Steve.
As you know, my mission is always to educate my listeners, and I remind you week after week, segment after segment, that we love your questions, because we do. These are complicated times, which makes for complicated topics, and I'm always here to answer them. So if you have questions about your portfolio, your kids' kids, your retirement, your 401k, how to take better care of your family, anything financial on your mind, I'm here with 35 years of experience, and I'd love to help you in any way I can. So go to stevepomerantz.com, go to the contact section, and let me know how we can help. That's stevepomerantz.com, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z, no T, stevepomerantz.com, and contact us one more time, stevepomerantz.com. You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. My guest is Jonathan Clements. He is the founder and editor of Humble Dollar. He's also the author of a fistful of personal finance books, including From Here to Financial Happiness and How to Think About Money. In a recent article on how, in his words, what he calls the five freedoms and the pursuit of money are so intertwined, I thought it was a terrific article, and I've asked Jonathan to come on to speak about it. Welcome back to the show, Jonathan.
Hey, Steve. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
It's great to have you. In your article, you referenced the inspiring speech given by FDR at the beginning of World War II. The four essential freedoms were listed there, and they were called. What were those four essential freedoms that FDR spoke about?
Yeah, this was a speech that FDR gave in early 1941. It was actually the State of the Union address. And he talked about four essential human freedoms: freedom of speech, of worship, from fear, and from want. And actually, I hadn't realized this until after I wrote the article and a reader got in touch with me. This reader actually sent me a series of stickers from the 1944 presidential campaign. And the four freedoms were what FDR campaigned on in 1944. But at the time, in 41, He was really preparing America to go to war.
Yeah, and giving a reason to go to war in terms of what we needed to protect.
Right. These were sort of, in FDR's mind, core American values. And I think that, you know, we would all agree with that today. Freedom of worship, of speech, from fear and from want. Those are things that we all want.
Well, you're a thoughtful guy, and you wrote an article thinking about those four and turning them into what you've come up with, which is five freedoms or dimensions that having money offers a person. So let's start with that. The first one is freedom from fear. Explain to us how money and freedom from fear are interrelated.
So when we think about money, you know, it's really a tool to enhance our lives. The goal isn't just to have a big pile of money. It's somehow to make our lives better. And this list of freedoms that I drew up are really an aspirational list, things that I think people should strive for. And freedom from fear is at the top of the list. I mean, we all want a sense of financial security. And yet, you know, the data tell us that many Americans don't have that, that they live paycheck to paycheck. They worry about how they're going to pay the monthly bills. They worry how they would fare if they lost their job. But the research also points to an interesting solution to all of this. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has done surveys to measure America's sense of financial well-being. And what they found is the biggest driver of financial well-being is simply having a little bit of money in the bank. Mm-hmm. If you can accumulate $5,000 in a checking account or a savings account or some other kind of cash account that you have easy access to, that can measurably improve your sense of financial well-being.
The idea of knowing that if there is an unforeseen circumstance, a financial hit of some kind, that there's money there to cover it can offer you a lot of peace of mind.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we know is that we're not very good at predicting the future. And that, I'm not just talking about the stock market and the direction of interest rates. We're also very bad at predicting what's going to happen in our own lives. We're not very good at anticipating that we will have rough times. And yet, the fact is, there are very few normal months. Almost every month, there's a surprise expense that we somehow have to cope with. And if you have that money in the bank, you'll be in a better position to cope with those surprises.
I don't think there's any question that having excess money will reduce our fear of, you know, what the ramifications of an uncertain world and so on. So let's move to number two, freedom from financial dependence.
So as I explained in the article, we're all dependent on one another to some degree, right? We expect others to help us by providing us with goods and services. None of us, you know, are completely free of other individuals. And certainly, you know, we wouldn't want a world where that was the case, where we all lived isolated existences. But to the extent that you are financially dependent on others, it does create some level of anxiety. I mean, I certainly don't want to be dependent on charity. I don't want to be dependent on the kindness of strangers, on a government program. I don't want to be dependent upon my family. So to the extent that you can ensure that you have the money so that you are not dependent on others financially, that is a good thing. And I would take this one step further, Steve, which is this financial dependence can even be extended to, you know, being employed. Mm-hmm. To some degree, you know, if you're relying on a company, a government institution, whatever it is, to provide you with a regular paycheck, that is a level of financial dependence. Now, if you love your job and you have a great boss, all's well and good. But if you have a bad boss, and I've had a few of those in my lifetime, being dependent on that paycheck can feel sort of uncomfortable. And that's one of the pleasures that comes with being retired or running your own business, is that you are far less dependent on others in terms of that paycheck you have month to month.
You know, it's one of the reasons I never entered the corporate world. I didn't really want my livelihood to be dependent upon the vagaries of politics or of changes in direction in the company or a capricious boss. I wanted to have more financial security. And in the business I was in, which was the investment advisor business, you know, I had hundreds of bosses, so to speak. So if I were to be fired by one, it didn't hurt my livelihood. So I felt much more secure. And that was one reason that I really enjoy the investment advisory business so much, is the fact that there is a measure of independence from a singular source of power, let's say.
I absolutely agree with you. And I would say that being an employee of a large institution, you know, go back a couple of decades, that was actually considered to be relatively desirable. Large institutions were considered to be relatively stable. You could stay in the job for many decades as long as you did a half decent job. That simply isn't the case anymore. Even if you're excellent at what you do, in the next restructuring, you could be out of a job, no matter how good your employee reviews are, no matter how many hours you put in. So being an employee has a downside. And, you know, in certain situations, it can be very uncomfortable and lead to a lot of financial distress.
The third freedom is freedom from financial obligations. What are you referring to there?
Well, again, we all have regular financial obligations, the mortgage or rent, the car payments, whatever it is. We do need to buy goods and services to keep ourselves going. But to the extent that those financial obligations consume a large part of your income, it's going to create anxiety. It's going to make your life seem more tenuous. So one of the rules of thumb that I often suggest to people is that you should make sure that your fixed living expenses, the mortgage, the rent, the insurance premiums you pay, the utilities, the regular grocery bill, and so on, that those should not be eating up more than half of your pre-tax income. And to the extent that you can get it even lower, all the better, because the lower your fixed costs are relative to your income, one, you'll find it much easier to save money, but two, you'll also have extra money for so-called discretionary expenses, the fun stuff in life, going on vacation, going out to dinner, taking the family to an amusement park, going with your spouse to a concert or the theater. Those are the things that make life special, and you want to have the money to do those things. And the way you do that is by keeping your fixed monthly financial obligations as small as possible.
Yeah. This idea of being house poor is the way we used to say it. So you may have a large house and you may enjoy that house, but there's really no room for anything else in your life for discretionary spending. So you don't want to be house poor. You want to keep everything within. And, you know, everybody has financial constraints. I mean, you know, millionaires don't have unlimited resources. You might think a billionaire, which, you know, it's kind of stupid to talk about them. But, you know, if they've got 17 homes all over the world, you know, they're going to come up against some financial constraints. So resources are not unlimited really for everybody. So we have to remember that. Let's move to number four, which is freedom from our own wants. That was an interesting one. Tell us about that.
So in the psychological literature, there's this word. I only came across it last year, but I love the word. The word is miswanting. And what academic psychologists mean by miswanting is that we set our sights on something, often a material good, and we want it so badly because we're sure it's going to vastly improve our lives. And yet, more often than not, even if we get this possession that we desperately, desperately want, we might get a brief thrill out of it, but often it doesn't improve our lives. And instead, all it does is lead to a much smaller bank account. So we need to become much more thoughtful about how we spend our money so that we avoid this miswanting. And one of the things that I encourage people to think about when they contemplate spending money on a major purchase or something else is to say to themselves, what will my future self think about the money that I spend today? Because when you spend money today, what you're doing is not only buying something that your future self is going to have to live with, but also spending money that your future self will not have to spend. And worse still, if you go into debt to make this purchase, your future self is going to have to repay the money involved. So as you spend money today, think about the implications for your future self, and to the greatest extent possible, try to make sure that your future self is not unhappy.
Well, if you think about making decisions to take care of your loved ones, then I guess you should include your future self as one of your loved ones and get this idea in your head that, you know, looking back, your future self is going to say, you know, either you did good for me, thank you, or, you know, why did you do something so idiotic? In the interest of time, we've got one more here. Freedom to use our time as we wish.
And this is about, more than anything, using your money to create time, because ultimately time is the limited resource. You know, you're going to run out of time before you run out of money. So you want to make the best possible use of the time that you have. When you're in the workforce, buying time might mean hiring somebody to mow the lawn or clean the house to get you out of the chores that you really dislike doing. Later, if you're successful financially, you may be able to buy time in the sense that you leave that corporate job that you hate and opt for a career that's less lucrative, but which you may find more fulfilling. And ultimately, we have retirement, where your time is totally your own. I mean, that is true financial independence. And it's a goal that we should all strive for, because time is so valuable. And you want to be able to call the shots on how you spend each and every day.
Good advice from Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of The Humble Dollar. Of Humble Dollar, go to humbledollar.com. And to hear this in any interview again, if you have a question, we love to get your questions. And remember to visit our website, which is stevepomerantz.com, to join our conversation. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update for upcoming live events and the important topics we've covered this week straight into your inbox every single week. That's stevepomerantz.com. Jonathan, thanks so much once again for coming here and joining us today.
It was a great conversation, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. It's time for a real estate roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 31-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Just recently, we did some segments on predictions that realtors made 10 years ago, looking 10 years ahead, back when, in 2010. Now we want to take a look at 2020 and see what some of those predictions are, again, now going forward another 10 years. Now, 10 years is a long time, right?
Yep, it sure is.
Yeah. So you were just doing some exercises in your office with regards to goal setting, and you were looking at 5 years, and that's hard enough.
Right. 10 years, I don't see it. I still think George Jetson and the little space vehicles we'll be driving around in.
I know.
I don't know if that's 10 years or 30 years or 50 years.
Well, the first projection is that in 10 years, condos and townhomes will become more desirable than single-family homes because there's less time-consuming upkeep and maintenance.
Hmm, that could be true. The way I want to look at this is, what's the age? You know, are all the baby boomers now, 10 years from now, totally aging out? So based on that, I would say yes.
Well, we have some information on that because we recently did an episode where we looked at some studies with regards to what boomers are doing, and they're staying in their homes longer.
Right.
So if a boomer is 65 or even 70 and, you know, they're 80, they're not necessarily moving out to an assisted living facility.
No.
That's a relatively young age still.
Right.
So maybe not in 10 years, but of course the millennials are coming up, and millennials, I think, lean more towards easy does it, easy maintenance, and move in. Everything has to be
set up, they want it that way.
They don't really want to move in and have to do construction and all of that.
They watch too much HGTV.
We're going to get into that in a minute, by the way. Okay. All right, let's see what else some of these people are saying. So again, they're predicting the rise of technology.
Absolutely. We see it now.
It will increase its role. The rise of online home selling apps.
Yes.
The use of social media and the growth of smart home technology.
Yep. All of that I see. It's happening now. It's just going to continue to grow.
Now, you're remodeling your home.
Right.
Right. You just told me off air. Are you putting any smart home technology in?
No, I don't care for talking to a device that's going to turn on my lights.
Yeah.
I like to get up and turn on my own lights.
Yeah.
Plus, I'm a little freaked out as to who's listening.
Yeah. There seems to be that thing. If there's a camera in your house, even if it's looking out, there's access in.
Right.
And whether we're just we have layperson fears, and we don't really know what we're talking about. It's still a fear.
It's a fear.
Mind you. Okay. Another trend could be, or is expected to be, sustainable real estate with environmental and socially conscious business practices being a much more important part of the real estate equation.
Yes, that's true.
You're seeing that now, by the way?
I do. I think people are more conscientious of the environment, so they are looking into it. Just take, for example, the light bulbs.
Yeah, the new LEDs. Yeah.
So everyone's getting rid of the older ones and they're putting in the LEDs. So that's just one small example.
Also, you know, I hated paying more for the LEDs, but I have these high ceilings and it's... And they don't burn out.
No, they don't. So, they'll outlive you. It's kind of like a parrot.
I never thought of that. I'm never getting a parrot. But anyway, so the LEDs are definitely in a move in that direction. Now, affordability, that doesn't tell me anything, but transportation, mass transportation is going to be extremely important.
Yeah, we're seeing that here in South Florida. You know, they're bringing the Bright Line down further.
Yeah.
And I've had people... you know, comment, listen, I don't have to go to Miami that often, but when I do, I now know I can hop on the Bright Line. So they're looking to move further out. They don't want to be in Miami and they feel they want to be in good schools that they can come out to Boca and have that easy access to.
Well, I never would have taken a train down to Miami, but now we're considering doing that because first of all, I think the train's nice. It seems like fun. And the connections are pretty good from what I understand.
Yes.
I'm hearing positive feedback when people use the Bright Line.
Yep.
So it makes me want to try that. I can see now, because really the traffic is horrendous.
It's getting really bad.
So if you can avoid that by going mass transit, I think it's pretty attractive. All right. So mass transit is going to be an important thing. All right. So another thing that people are going to be looking for in the future are amenities. They want dog runs. They want roof decks. They want work-friendly spaces. Those are becoming important, especially in urban areas. Are we seeing anything like that down here?
You know, we are, Steve. As a matter of fact, there's some communities that are being built, you know, north and west of us, way the heck out there. They offer so much in amenities that people are willing to do the commute because they have so much to offer them. Mm-hmm. So while they feel like they don't have to leave their environment, it's almost like country clubs with...
Oh, yeah. So it's all self-contained.
It's all self-contained. There's some communities that are building regional hospitals. I mean, big cities. They're almost like cities.
They are like cities. Well, you know, considering how far west those places are and how long it takes to go east now, because our highways are so clogged, you can see that they're trying to make everything just stay out there. So these people will never see the beach again.
They're going to stay in the community and be happy.
Okay. All right. So some other future trends. Someone says, look out for the silver tsunami, in which 77 million baby boomers will have to sell homes to downsize and move to retirement facilities in the upcoming years. According to researchers at Zillow, 9 million of these residents will hit the market between 2017 and 2027.
That's good.
So there's your inventory.
Right. There's my inventory. I just have to wait 7 more years.
What are these silverites going to buy? That's the question.
That's always the question. Okay.
By roughly 2037, 21 million homes will have been sold as a result of the baby boomers. And let's see what else it says here. The real estate industry, from rental and residential to commercial, will rapidly transition from a manual and paper-laden process, which it is.
Yes, it is.
To the end-to-end digital experience in the next 10 years. Investors have been pouring money into prop tech ventures that utilize machine learning, artificial intelligence, and real-time big data analytics to cater to the needs of tech-savvy millennials and Gen Z, who continue to take over the market as the main demographics of renters. So yeah, I mean, look, the paperwork is ridiculous. It's so old school.
It's definitely going paperless, even signing your closing documents.
I think eventually renters will be able to lease an apartment in a matter of minutes by filling out a few questions, snapping a selfie. That will enable an algorithm to quickly build and vet their application in real time. Long time coming for that kind of stuff.
Yep, I can see that happening.
Yeah, me too. Okay, we are out of time. My guest, as always, is Terry Story, a 31-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton. And she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve. Thank you.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. The Congressional Budget Office recently forecast annual federal deficits of more than $1 trillion for 2020, and also each of the next 10 years as well. They say that by 2030, the deficit will hit $1.7 trillion. Economists generally think a fiscal deficit of around 3% of our GDP is healthy and manageable. U.S. deficits over the next decade will average 4.8%, according to the CBO. Let's kick this around with one of my favorite guests. He is Rick Neumann, a columnist for Yahoo Finance, the author of four books, including Rebounders, How Winners Pivot from Setback to Success. I follow his column regularly, and you should too. Rick, welcome to the program.
Always enjoy it.
Great. Well, so what is driving these trillion-dollar deficits I speak about?
Two things, basically. One of them is healthcare costs. The federal government pays a lot for healthcare. That's mostly Medicare and Medicaid. It also pays a lot for Social Security, but that's in better position than Medicare is. And as anybody who's ever been to the doctor knows, healthcare costs are going up by more than overall inflation. They're going up by more than average incomes. And they're just taking a bigger bite out of everybody's budget, including Uncle Sam's. Mm-hmm. And Washington has not figured out what to do about that. So that's part of it. The second part is the Trump tax cuts, which went into effect at the beginning of 2018, are making this situation a little bit worse. So the federal government is bringing in less revenue than it would have been bringing in under the old tax regime. Now, the supporters of that tax cut said, don't worry, it's going to stimulate so much additional economic activity that we're going to actually be bringing in more tax revenue, not less tax revenue. But that has not happened yet. And the Congressional Budget Office, which you just mentioned, in their outlook for the next 10 years, they don't think that's going to happen either.
So that was all based on, from what I recently read, an idea which was put on the back of a napkin during the Reagan era. And that is, it's called the Laffer Curve, L-A-F-F-E-R, not L-A-U-G-H-E-R.
Some people laugh at it, though.
Yeah, some people do. And the idea was that if you raise taxes to a certain point, it reduces government revenue because people feel disincented to work. And that at some point, as taxes come down, people are more productive, they want to work, they want to make more money, and that adds to the tax base. So I think that was the idea behind that tax cut. So what really has happened? This is the $64,000 question. I ask this a lot to people. What do you think has happened because of those tax cuts in addition to creating this huge deficit?
Yeah, and the Laffer curve you're referring to, that's named after Art Laffer. He's a supply-side economist. He actually is a supporter of President Trump's policies and kind of an informal advisor to Trump. Mm-hmm. This theory has been out there for a few decades, you know, the idea being that if you lower taxes enough, it puts more money in people's pockets. So consumers spend more money and businesses spend more money. And that is the stimulus, the so-called supply side stimulus effect, except it has never happened that way. And we have a real world case we can look at now with the tax cuts that went into effect in 2018. So if you look at tax receipts that the U.S. Treasury is bringing in, corporate tax revenue, that's federal revenue that comes from businesses paying taxes, that has gone down significantly. And as a measure of all federal revenue, corporate tax revenue is at the lowest level ever as a percentage of all revenue. Corporate tax brings in something like maybe $250 billion per year. Income tax revenue, that's individuals paying income taxes, has gone up a little bit, even though the tax cuts from 2018 did cut those rates a little bit. But we have more people working and we've had economic growth. So overall revenue for individuals has gone up a little bit, but not as much as it would have under the old tax regime. And then meanwhile, as we just discussed, you've got healthcare expenditures paid by the government going up by more than all of this. And that's where we get to the deficits. And one important thing that has not happened, this is very important, we have not seen an increase in business spending since the tax cuts. That was one of the main arguments in favor of those tax cuts, because the biggest part of the tax cut really was that cut in the corporate rate from 35% to 21%. And we've actually seen flatlining business spending, and it has just not picked up. I mean, businesses are just not spending money on new factories, on buying new equipment. I mean, there could be several reasons for that. Nobody knows exactly why, but we're just not seeing any of the stimulus effect that the backers of that tax cut said we would see.
Yeah. So it reminds me of Donald Trump's method to managing his business. He would buy properties, he would take on loads of debt, and, you know, on average, he was successful, but there's a lot of areas where he was not successful, a lot of bankruptcies and so on. So it's kind of like the country's got the same thing. We now have leveraged ourselves up over $1 trillion. Now, we're not supposed to have a deficit this size when the economy is good. Now, when the economy is bad, tax receipts go down because business is slower and the government is stimulating, so spending is higher, and you expect to go into a deeper deficit. And then when the economy improves, you expect tax revenues to increase and stimulus spending to decline, and then you kind of get back to normal. So this is a time when we have historically low unemployment, businesses are doing well, corporate profits are rising and so on, and yet we're at a period of highest deficit. So eventually, moving on with this idea, you know, these deficits at some point, nobody seems to know the point because, you know, I've been involved in the investment community now for 40 years, and I started out in the Reagan era, the beginning of the Reagan era, and they were talking about high deficits, government borrowing conflicting with corporate and individuals borrowing, interest rates were going to rise. None of that has really happened. There is some number which gets us to a place where we hurt, but I don't think anybody knows where that number is. Do you?
I have no idea. And economists have all kinds of different ideas about this. You know, many economists thought that we would be having problems by now. But, you know, the old way of thinking, which you talked about going back to the Reagan years and even in the Clinton years, I mean, people forget this. We had 4 years of budget surpluses from 1998 through 2001. That used to be what happened fairly normally when the economy was strong. You got all this tax revenue, and we actually had a little bit left over after all the spending. But I think the thing that's new in the way economists are thinking about this is we have extraordinarily low interest rates indefinitely. I mean, You know, interest rates right now are way below long-term averages, and there's no sign they're going to go up. And I think if you had asked economists, I mean, I know what they were predicting 10 years ago, no one thought interest rates would be as low as they are right now. And that's important because one of the line items in the federal budget is interest payments on that federal debt. And, you know, with 10-year treasuries are what, around 2%?
Less than that.
You know, interest payments are very, very low. And if that would go up to, I mean, what's normal, you might say that 6% or probably between 5 and 6% is the historical norm. If we had interest rates at that level, we would have a problem because we'd have a lot more of this revenue would have to go just to pay the debt. And that can become a mushrooming problem. So for now, we're sort of off the hook on that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, nobody knows when this, you know, the so-called bond vigilantes have been worrying about this for a long time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, their worst case predictions have just not come true. And nobody knows if they ever will.
If you think of this as a household, if you think of the United States as a household, you think that the amount of debt that you have is only important if, as you measure it against your level of income. You know, $10,000 in debt for someone who's making $1 million is meaningless. $10,000 in debt to someone who's making $30,000 is meaningful. So it's all really relative. So we have to remember that the GDP of the United States is continually growing. We're a bigger country, or think of it as a company or as a family, whatever. We are bigger now than we were 10 years ago, than we were 20 years. We're much bigger. So we can afford to take on more debt. That's not the problem. We don't really know the answer to this, but what I want to do is I want to shift our focus and ask the question, if at some point the piper will have to be paid, what is that going to look like in the years hence?
Yeah, and the piper is going to have to be paid because of this healthcare problem. I mean, the forecasts are terrible. Medicare is going to start running short of money by 2026. That's the latest projection. That's only 6 years away. That is not so far off into the future that you can basically forget about it. And everybody knows, I mean, healthcare, we have baby boomers now streaming into Medicare. It's just not going to be sustainable. So the good news is that, you know, the United States is a relatively low tax nation. I mean, the tax burden on the typical family here in the United States is lower than it is in most other countries of the world, you know, for a bunch of different reasons, but because we have the dollar, I mean, that's a big part of it, the world's reserve currency. But at some point, we're going to need more revenue. And, you know, I don't know if you can call it good news, but we can raise revenue in a bunch of different ways. And there are some tax experts who've been looking at this recently, and there was a big book published by the Hamilton Project, which is part of the Brookings Institution think tank in Washington. And they're saying there are new ways you could impose an inheritance tax that would be supplemental, or it might replace the estate tax, which really raises almost no revenue anymore. There's this wealth tax that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are talking about, problematic, but it might work. The biggest one would be a value-added tax, which basically all the advanced countries in the world have, except the United States. That could raise a ton of money fast.
Let's talk about a value-added tax. So if you've ever been abroad, you'll notice that all goods have this extra tax on. It's like a sales tax, right? Yeah, we have sales tax in the state of Florida.
Well, people yell at me when I try to use that shorthand.
Yeah.
To consumers, it is the equivalent of a national sales tax. It's administered in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, from a consumer's perspective, that's how it works. You pay a little bit more at the point of purchase.
Yeah. So I think, and if I remember correctly, when I was in Italy, it's 15% or some number like that. I know it often changes. So the stuff that you buy is increased by the amount of that value-added tax. You don't actually see it because it's built into the price. I think that's the differentiation between a sales tax, is that in the state of Florida, we add 6%.
Yes. I mean, at a technical level, the way you would administer it is it would be a tax at various levels of production. So this tax will be paid by whoever is producing or providing the good and service at some point in the production process, which makes it actually very efficient. I mean, it's relatively easy to impose a tax like that because it's easy to collect. You know, then those providers and producers, they can raise their prices a little bit and pass all of it or some of it on to consumers. I mean, the market sort of figures that out. But that's why, of all, not that they like taxes, but economists do like this tax as taxes go because it's relatively efficient and it can raise a lot of money.
Well, according to what you wrote, a 10% VAT tax would raise around $1 trillion per year. I guess that's from the Brookings Institution.
That's a lot of money.
That's an awful lot, and that would do a lot to fix this thing. I mean, all of these things right now are off the table because, you know, the idea of any kind of higher taxes, and especially I think the idea of a VAT tax in the United States is very unpopular, the idea. But again, we're just looking at some alternatives. So a new inheritance tax, right now it's just 2.1%. And so increasing that would raise some tax. A wealth tax, I've read articles pro and con. That's something that some of the Democratic runners are talking about. What is that?
Well, it depends who you're asking, but Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are the main proponents of this. And they have some well-known economists helping them out with the analysis. Basically, you would impose just a tax. Pick your number. Elizabeth Warren's begins at 2%. That's what she calls it, 2 cents. What she means is 2 cents of every dollar, but let's say starting at $35 million, and this is wealth, not income.
Mm-hmm. That's tough.
The idea behind this tax is that very wealthy people don't have a lot of labor income. I mean, a lot of them don't even work. They make all their money from investments, and they pay at the capital gains rate, which is much lower than the regular rate that working people pay generally. So the idea is to tax some of that wealth, because we have a lot of wealth inequality in the United States, and that's getting worse. So let's say it's a 2% figure above $35 million that would be assessed every year.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you would just have to value all the stuff you have. That includes your houses, your portfolio, your investments, but also your real estate, your artwork, your jewelry. I mean, all these things. So
it lies the problem. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So there's the problem. Number one is it's hard to value. Can be hard to value anyway. And the other problem is there is a clause in the Constitution that may seem to prohibit this kind of tax, and it gets technical. But if Congress were to impose a wealth tax, it would be challenged immediately on constitutionality basis. And if, I mean, let's call it 50-50 based on how that would end up going. But, you know, it'd be a long court fight, and it would probably go to the Supreme Court. So that does not seem, you know, we have other ways we can impose taxes that we know work. So maybe stick with the ones that work.
Yeah, well, we're low on time. So a financial transaction tax would put a fee of 0.1% on every financial transaction, stocks, bonds, exchange-traded funds, all of these things, there would be a tax just on the transaction portion of it. And then, of course, there's always higher corporate taxes to try to capture some more of that money back. So I think these things, or some variety of these things, are in our future. And it's a question of how much the population is really going to put up with higher taxes now that we're also kind of used to, you know, being in a time period of very low taxes.
Yeah, and I think you had it right before. We're hearing a lot of discussion about these various things in the Democratic presidential campaign. So I think it's worth listening to the different ideas the candidates have and notice the differences. But I think you had it right before. It's really unlikely that we're going to see any tax hikes until they're completely necessary.
Yeah,
I do think they are going to be completely necessary at some point. We're not going to have a choice. I'm not sure that's going to be next year or the year after that, but it's coming.
My guest, Rick Newman, columnist for Yahoo Finance. Follow him on Yahoo. Again, his name is Rick Newman. He's a great columnist, writes about a lot of different topics, and I'm a regular reader. Rick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
I want to remind you all that my mission is always to educate you and remind you week after week, segment after segment, that we love to get your questions because we do. These are complicated times, as you can see from the topics that I choose. And these complicated topics may raise some questions for you, and we're always here to answer them. So if you have questions about your portfolio, your kids' kids, your retirement, your 401k, how to better take care of your family, anything financial on your mind, we're here to help you, and I'd love to help you in any way I can. So go to stevepomerantz.com, go to the contact section, and let me know how we can help. That's stevepomerantz.com, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com, and contact us. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Malzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.